Reading in Matthew chapter 24, if you'd turn there with me, Matthew chapter 24. I know that this chapter here has all kinds of, I'm just looking for my, I need my clicker, guys, at some point here. Matthew 24 has all kinds of controversy associated with that in the premillennialist world, as well as even among the brotherhood. A lot of people see this as dealing with one thing when in fact it's dealing with another. Let's look at what it says first of all. Matthew chapter 24, starting in verse 1. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. So they're obviously in Jerusalem here. And he said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down." And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, which is across from the valley of Jerusalem there, or the valley between Jerusalem, across from the Jerusalem there, on the hill overlooking it, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age," or simply the consummation of the age. The disciples' questions here have nothing to do with the end of the world, like many people suspect, but rather the end of the age. In essence, the end of the Jewish age, or the time in which Jerusalem is the center of God and the law of Moses is still binding, or the center of the worship of God, I should say, and the law of Moses still binding upon the Jews. The destruction of the city would be likened to the destruction of the nation. We also know in chapter 4, verse 21 through 24, Jesus is talking to the Samaritan woman, and if I could just condense that summary of that conversation, he says in essence that God's people are no longer going to be tied to a city or to a nation, but all who worship the Father in spirit and truth will be the people of God. That there's not going to be a geographical center for that worship any longer, as there has been for the last well over 1,000 years in Jesus' day. We do also know that in AD 66, about 30 some odd years after Jesus said these words, that there was a Jewish resistance of Roman occupation in Palestine, and that resistance reached a boiling point. The Jewish zealots rose up and attacked and destroyed several garrisons in the Palestinian area there, killing many of the Roman soldiers. Rome's relationship with Judea had long been strained, of course, but this was the last straw. So what Rome did is that they sent in a general named Vespasian to lead an army to capture Palestine and destroy Jerusalem. Jerusalem responded with closing up the city. The Romans laid siege around the city. Vespasian was called back to Rome to become the emperor, and his son Titus finished the job. And in AD 70, the city was destroyed, and every building was leveled, not one stone left upon another, which is exactly what Jesus said would happen. And while that is very intriguing, that's not really Jesus' ultimate lesson, nor is it ours. We are no longer facing the end of Jerusalem, but we are facing the end of the world. And I don't mean like this week or next week necessarily, but that is the next big cataclysmic event. And as sure as Jesus' promise was to the Jews that Jerusalem would be destroyed and bring into an end the Jewish nation, the Jewish age, so the Holy Spirit's promise to the present generation is the same thing. And it's just as sure. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. Then we, in Acts chapter 1, verse 9 through 11, we see Jesus ascending up off the earth into heaven, and the angels there said, in the same way in which he has left, that is, into the clouds, so he will come in the clouds. And Paul says that too in 1 Thessalonians 4. And then we have Peter in 2 Peter 3, verse 11, where he says, "Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness?" That's a good question. What ought we to be doing while the Master is away? Because he most certainly is coming back. And we today stand between two Advents. Advents meaning an appearance. We stand between two appearances. First of all, Christ's first coming in the flesh, as we know that he did. John chapter 1, verse 14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That was the first advent. The second one will be coming in our future someday. You may not be alive on this earth, but it will be in your future regardless. So the same question is posed. Since we know what is coming, what are we doing to be prepared for what is coming? And particularly, what are you doing? Because we do want to make it personal. We don't want to just say, what are we doing as a group? But what are you doing? What am I doing? What is each one of us doing? We're going to look at Matthew 24 and 25 just in a very cursory way here in a kind of a survey approach, because there's so much going on there, and that would take way too much time to try to develop all of these ideas. But in verse 42 through 51 that Mike had read for us there, Jesus makes a startling statement. He says, the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Now, while the context of that statement deals with the destruction of Jerusalem, the principle of that statement does extend to any coming of Jesus, and particularly the end of the entire world. Jerusalem was destroyed because Jerusalem and the nation of the Jews, which Jerusalem symbolized, rejected their king. Well, the world is in the process of rejecting the king that God has appointed over all the world in heaven and on earth and all of the universe, and that is not going to bode well for the world in due time when the king returns. And so he's going to be coming like a thief in the night, and those are his words. In other words, when he is least expected. Otherwise, we would all prepare for that, wouldn't we? And when I say we, I don't just mean our group, but just people in general. If you knew when the thief was going to come, well, you'd be there prepared to ward off the thief or confront him and stop him from being, the thief. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 45, he asks the question rhetorically, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Well, those who are faithful and sensible have no better knowledge of when the master's coming than anyone else. But here's the difference. They are prepared. Regardless of when the master comes, they are prepared for his return. And they are busy doing what the master assigned them to do. And that is the distinction between, between the two groups of people there. You have those who are prepared for the master's return and everyone else who is unprepared. Whoever they are and however they're unprepared, doesn't even matter. They're unprepared for the return. And then Matthew chapter 24 and verse 48, but if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and then goes on and does what he does there in response to that, then bad things are going to happen to him. Instead of preparing and working and anticipating the return of the master, he takes wrongful advantage of that situation to gratify his own desires, to mistreat his own people, and to act carelessly with regard to his own future. And as you continue to read, that doesn't work out at all for him. What's happening today? We have people who are abandoning their moral responsibility. They're acting carelessly toward their God, and they're acting carelessly in mistreating one another. That's what happens when people don't believe that the master is coming back, or he won't come back for a long time. Then we look at Matthew chapter 25, which starts a series of parables that Jesus speaks in response to this situation. Verse 1 through 13, this is Jesus' parable of the 10 virgins who are waiting for the coming of the bridegroom to the father's house, that is. In the ancient Oriental culture, the bridegroom would be coming, the bridegroom being the husband-to-be, would be coming to his father's house to really finalize that ceremony, and then all his friends and relatives would be there waiting for him. Now, I've put up here on the screen that the bridegroom is Christ, the bride is his church, the church before it enters into glory, that is, and the virgins are members of the earthly church. In my opinion, I think Jesus initially is talking about the Jews, but we see the application, the principle extending in the same way here toward the church. The Jews have been waiting for the Messiah, but by extension, we are also waiting for the return of the Messiah, the return of Christ here. So we're not seeing a depiction of a mixed company of believers and unbelievers, Christians and non-Christians. We're seeing, if we extend this to ourselves, we're seeing a picture of Christians. And here's the two groups within that group. There are those who are prepared for the Master's return, and there are those who are unprepared. Once again, we have those who have enough oil, if you will, for their lamps, and we have those who don't have enough oil. So Jesus' message through the parable is, be ready for my return. It will not come soon. It will not come predictably, but it will come. It will happen. And don't be caught off guard, because once he appears, just like in the parable, there will be no time to regroup and readdress and respond differently other than to be cast out from the wedding party. There will be no second chances. And so it will be with the second coming. Once he appears, it's over. You're either going to be ready or you're not going to be ready. And keep in mind, he is speaking to his people, and we are his people. And we are either going to be ready or we're not. When the kids play hide and go seek, what does the guy say once he's done counting? Ready or not, here I come. And that's exactly what the scenario is, that Jesus is saying to us, ready or not, I am coming. Best be ready. And then in Matthew chapter 25, verse 14 through 30, we have another parable, this one about the talents. A talent is a unit of money, by the way, although that we see talent can be used metaphorically for like advantages or responsibilities and things like that. But in the parable, it has to do with money. The master entrusts money to his servants. The master is about to go on a journey, referring to himself, going into the heavenly realm, the spiritual realm. But when he returns, he's going to settle accounts with those to whom he entrusted the money. This is not a parable about money usage per se, although I do think there is something to say about that, but that extends beyond what we're talking about. Really, it has to do with our responsibility to the master toward whatever he has entrusted to us. So it necessarily implies that the servants are supposed to do something with what's entrusted to them. He does not give them money for safekeeping, but rather as an investment. And these people that he gives the money to, these different servants, they are expected to turn a profit with what he's given them. And there is an implication, too, that they all had ability and opportunity to do so. It's not like he gave the five-talent man five talents to do something that the one-talent man couldn't do anything with. No, it's just that the five-talent man had more responsibility than the one, but they all had ability and opportunity. And that is key to understanding this particular parable. So Jesus' message through the parable, in essence, is be busy while I'm gone. Do not sit idle, and do not bury your talent. And also do not misread the situation and think that the master is being unfair or overbearing by asking you to work and make sacrifices for him, especially in light of what you stand to gain if you just do what he said to do. You'll gain far more than money. So then we have two messages. First of all, be ready for his return. Secondly, be busy while he's gone, which leads to the third parable, and that is that there will be an accounting, a day of reckoning after his return, which is told to us in Matthew 25, verse 31 through 46, this great judgment scene. This is not to be literalized, like there's literal sheep and goats, right? They're not talking about herds of animals here. We're talking about people who identify as sheep or goats based on how they handled the situation that was given to them. Likewise, they're not literally separated on the right and the left, although the right, historically and biblically, refers to this, the position of power and acceptance. Doesn't bode well for us left-handers. But anyway, That is traditionally how it is viewed. And yet it is not presented as a parable, like a story or an illustration. It is presented as a real event. In my opinion, for what it's worth, it is nonetheless dumbed down for our understanding and is intended to press a necessary point in its dumbing it down for us. Those on the right or the left are not Christians and non-Christians, but they are all God's people from all nations. It's similar to like in Revelation 7, verse 9, where it says that there was this huge multitude that no one could count. Well, that multitude, that huge multitude, is all God's people. And in this parable here, or in this account here, all claim to identify with Jesus, and all claim, at least originally or up front, to be faithful to him. Everyone in the judgment scene initially is expecting to be received by the master and to gain a reward. But that's not how it pans out. So Jesus, who is the Son of Man in the account here, and who presides as a judge over both parties, asks, in essence, what did you do while I was away? And instead of letting each group speak for itself, Jesus tells them what he has observed. To the goats on the left, he says, you did not take care of me. And their response is, well, if we had ever seen you, of course we would have taken care of you. And what he says, in essence, is, you failed to see me in those who belong to me. You failed to see that I was there through those people. And they go away into an awful judgment. And the question is not just why did they fail to see him, but what were they doing instead? If they didn't take care of his people, then what were they doing instead? And that doesn't get addressed here, but it is a question that we should consider. Now, to the sheep on the right, Jesus says, as the judge, the Son of Man in this account, he says, you did take care of me. And those people are kind of bewildered, like, well, when did we take care of you? We never saw you actually or personally in our presence. And Jesus says, when you took care of those who belong to me, you did take care of me, because by extension, you took care of me through them, which is what the other group failed to do. So the point is made here that Jesus makes very clear that taking care of his people is a priority while the master is away. Now, I've said a lot so far. We've covered a lot of territory, whether you realize it or not. I just want us to pause for a minute here. Just take a moment to reflect on what has been said. And also, who has been saying it? And I don't mean me here, but rather Jesus himself is the one from whom all of this information has just come to us. It's not through an apostle, although that would be just as valid. It's not through some preacher, although that could be just as valid. It's not through someone that you know, or a friend of yours, or a family member, or anyone else. It is from the master himself, who tells you what to do while the master is away, and also what not to do. So take a minute just to let all that sink in. And once again, recall that we are living between two advents, or two appearances. The first appearance of Christ in the flesh, the second appearance of Christ in the clouds. And we know that Jesus has come, because that is the basis for our belief system. If you don't believe that Jesus has come, I got a question. What in the world are you doing here, right? Or why would you call yourself a Christian? But we also know that he is coming, and that also is a basis for our belief system. Because if you don't believe he's coming back, then again, what are you doing here, and why would you call yourself a Christian? So here we are between the two advents, and we're here in the middle. And we recognize that every time we take the Lord's Supper, because we look back in faith on what he did when he was here in the flesh and what he's going to do in the future. We proclaim his death until he comes. So here we are in the middle. And part of our belief system is on either side of that. This one saying, we know he came, and this one saying, we know he's coming. But that doesn't mean that we're doing what we should be doing just because we believe or say we believe in those things. I think of teenagers, for example. I was a teenager at one time, just a few years ago, and so I can identify with this, who obey their parents only when their parents are looking or around, but not when they're not. Y'all know what I'm talking about, because either you were there and you did that, or you know about that. Or I think about employees who are loyal to the company or loyal to the boss when the boss is in the room or the boss is in the warehouse or the boss is looking. But then when the boss goes away or turns his back, they are disloyal to the boss. I know that pretty well too, because I was the boss in the retail management position that I held for well over a decade. I was the boss, and I know what my employees were doing when I turned my back. Some of them were faithful. Some of them were loyal. Some of them fulfilled their jobs, and others of them took advantage of the situation. That's a false allegiance. When you are only doing what you're supposed to do when someone's looking, someone that, you know, can call you on that, when that person's there and looking, that's a false allegiance. But when you have a true allegiance or a sincere allegiance is when you're doing what that master said to do, whether that master is your parent or your boss or any other position of authority, you do what that master says to do, whether that person is there or not. That's a true allegiance. I want you to think about Christians now. We're all on our best behavior. When? When we're among our peers and when everyone's watching us. That's when we're on our best behavior. Well, like right now, right? We're all on our best behavior because everyone's watching everyone else. And I get that. When we're among peers and our fellow believers, that's the way we expect. But when that level of accountability is removed or relaxed, Do we do what we want? Do we still take this seriously? Or are we pledging allegiance to Jesus when we're baptized, when everyone's watching us, when all the attention's focused on us, but then letting anything and everything interfere with those pledges that we made with him in our baptism when everyone is looking the other way? That latter group of people represents those who are not ready for the master when he comes. So if you're wondering how it can happen in the modern world, in a contemporary sense, among Christians even today, there it is right there. We have some who are doing what they're supposed to be doing, regardless of who is watching, and even though the master is away. And then we have others who are taking advantage of the situation, being on their best behavior when everyone's watching, and when they are being called on the spot to do something, but when someone turns their back or when the pressure's off, the attention's off, they just basically do whatever they want. Those who are ready and prepared versus those who are not ready and unprepared. This lesson is not meant to target any particular person or situation or recent event. I want to make that very clear. However, it is to warn all of us against allowing ourselves to get soft and distracted and preoccupied and even lazy when we claim to be working for the master. By the way, if you think I'm talking about current events here, I actually wrote this lesson almost a year ago, before any of this shutdown stuff happened. So this is what was on my mind at that time to say. I just didn't have opportunity or didn't feel it was the right time to say it. I do feel it's the right time now. Genuine Christians are not identified by church directories or by church attendance or by knowledge of the Bible or by saying their prayers or by taking the Lord's Supper. That's not what identifies people as genuine Christians, but rather by keeping the Lord's commandments, and as 1 John 2 verse 4 through 6 says, by walking in the same manner as Christ walked. Whether he's watching or not, walking as he walked. Only these will be ready for him when he comes. All of this begs the question then, are we getting ready for his coming while he is away? And are you, in particular, getting ready for his coming? Someone might say, well, it's been 2,000 years so far. It's as if it will never happen. And I do understand that mentality. I have experienced that same thought myself. Like, Lord, if you're coming, just come and be done with it. Why wait? I mean, the world's a mess. It's not getting better. It's getting worse. So why wait? But that's not the Lord's thinking. That's just Chad's. And that's why we don't follow Chad's thinking, because the Lord's is so much better. But this is what 2 Peter does say in chapter 3, verse 3 and 4. Know this, first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts or their desires, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. And I know it's easy to descend into that kind of mentality there. It's not a good place to argue from, is what Peter's saying. It ignores what's been written. It ignores the promises that has been made. It actually distrusts the promise that is made and also distrusts the one who made the promise of his coming. And it guarantees, if you were to maintain that view, it guarantees that you are not ready for the master to return. It goes outside of this lesson, but for your own reading, 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 1 through 6, Paul reiterates what Jesus had already implied, that he is coming and that he will come like a thief in the night, and you'll either be ready or you won't be ready, but he's coming nonetheless. Ready or not, Jesus is coming. But he goes on to say there that the world has also been lulled into a false sense of security, and that the world, the unbelieving world, as well as really unbelieving Christians, are shrouded in moral darkness and moral confusion. But Paul says to the Christians, to the true believers, that we are to be alert and sober. From my observation of Christians in general, few people are taking this really seriously. And I know that might sound critical, but the facts are there. A few people are taking this seriously. We're seeing Christians who are identifying with the world much easier and much more than they are identifying with Christ and his church. And that's not becoming better over time. That's becoming worse over time. I liken it to going down a stream. I was talking with Daryl Bean this last week, and I liken it to going down a stream, and we're all on this very easy flowing river. In fact, Honey and I, we were in Central Oregon this summer, and we went paddleboarding down a river. Who thought, right, you could do that, paddleboarding down a river? And we were standing up on these paddleboards because the river was so soft and easy and quiet and calm, and there was no ripples or anything like that. Anyone can paddleboard down that. But the rapids are coming. So here we have been for years now, even decades for some of us, and we've been going down this soft and lazy river and saying, well, we're prepared, we're ready, we're disciplined, we're active, and so on. The rapids are now coming to test all that, and I don't know that all of us are ready for that. The rapids are coming. And you're not going to get away from that. And that's going to separate the men from the boys, so to speak. And it's going to separate the true believers from the unbelievers. And it's going to separate those who are prepared from those who are unprepared or really don't want to be prepared. The question is not about those two groups. Do they exist or not? Because they do. The question is, which group are you going to be in? You won't make that decision in the middle of the rapids. You make that decision right now. And that's what we're asking you to consider. Many Christians reason, well, of course I'll be ready by the time Jesus comes, but I got a lot of time until then. I've reasoned that way. I remember thinking that way. Old age? That's years and years to come, right? And now it's staring me in the face, and there's not that much time left. So what are we doing with the time that we have left? And that completely ignores Jesus' own message, because you don't know when he's going to be returning, because remember, he himself said he's going to come like a thief. How can you prepare for his coming when you don't know when he's coming? Except to be prepared all the time, to be ever prepared. The wise response is, whatever needs to be done to prepare, I need to do that now, today, while there is still today. Because that appeals to a sense of urgency rather than to a disposition of procrastination. Satan wants us to procrastinate because he knows where that leads us. Jesus wants us to have a sense of urgency because he knows how that helps us. The question is, which attitude or disposition are you choosing for yourself? And secondly, are we busy doing the Master's will while he is away? Are you doing that? And immediately we get resistance. You didn't do it yourself necessarily, but over time we have reached, or we have received, all kinds of resistance. Because people say something like, well, I would, of course, be doing the Master's will, except I have a family to raise, I have a secular job, and it's very pressing and time-consuming, I have family and friends to enjoy, I have retirement to enjoy, surely Christ will understand. Except that in all the parables, he just got done telling you he doesn't understand. He won't understand. So why are we saying that Jesus will understand when he's telling you he won't? The primary responsibility is to do what the Master said. Do you realize that all the goats reasoned the same way that we just described? I've got things to do, and I can't take time to, pay attention to all the people in the church and my responsibility. You remember all the goats in that scenario? They all reasoned the same way. That's a goat mentality. You don't want to operate on that. You want to have a sheep mentality. I don't mean blind, naively following like so many people portray sheep, but those who follow the shepherd, those who are obedient to the shepherd's will. Of course, you and I have earthly lives and secular responsibilities, but again, our primary responsibility is what Christ has given us to do, not what you or I decide to do otherwise. He is the Master. We made him our master when we were baptized into him. Matthew 24, verse 45 through 51, we have one group, but two different responses. We have those who are slaves that are responsible and productive and making every effort to fulfill what the master entrusted to them to do. And then we have a second group who are spending time and opportunity to seek personal gratification at the expense of others, but especially at the expense of the Lord. And only one group will be ready. Only one group will be prepared when the Master comes. So those choices that are made on both sides lead to a division of the group. Someone says, we can't divide the church. Well, actually, we can. We could just have one group that's prepared to receive the Master when he comes, and we have the other group who's unprepared for any reason. And that effectively divides any group. Those are choices that people make. God didn't make that for us. We make that ourselves, if indeed we go down two different paths. The group, which group are you in? Because you can't exempt yourself, and you can't be in both. Each of us is in one or the other. Which brings us to the third point of what exactly should we be doing, and that is serving Christ's people. Is that what we're doing while he is away? Now, I realize there's a lot of distraction going on this last 6 months with the shutdown and coronavirus and all kinds of implications from that and impositions from that. I get that. I believe that we have, at least temporarily, lost some sight of what we ought to be doing. And it's time for us to refocus. It's time for us to stop worrying about the masks and the coronavirus and all of these phases and everything else. I'm not saying we can make those things go away. What I'm saying is that is not what identifies us as God's people. What identifies us as God's people is that we are doing God's work. You need to ask yourself, what are you doing? What am I doing? Taking care of God's people is one of the most important things that we need to be doing. If it comes up in the judgment scene as the sole criterion of whether we are going to be with the sheep or the goats, and you know how important that is to Christ. It's been popular. I've heard it for decades. Someone says, I don't need to always have fellowship with other Christians. There's other ways to serve them. Well, of course, there's other ways to serve him, I should say. There's other ways to serve Christ and when you're not with fellow Christians. But that's not what Jesus said, that you can just choose, pick and choose whatever way you want to serve him and that will work. He said how you regard and how you treat his people directly impacts your future with him, either positively or negatively. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 9, John says, the one who says he is in the light and yet hates his brother is in the darkness until now. Someone says, well, I don't hate my brother, or I just don't like him, okay? Or I just don't spend time with him, or I just don't, you know, maybe check on him all the time. That doesn't mean I hate him. But if you look at the context of how John uses that phrase to hate your brother, it means to withhold love from him. And when your brother or sister in Christ needs your love, and you withhold that love from that brother or sister, and again, give that love to someone else, instead of them, at their expense, he equates that to showing hatred toward your brother and sister. When we give our love to things and jobs and hobbies and our pets and unbelievers at the expense of God's people, we are withholding what we promised to give to God's people, and that is our love, and we are hating them. That's what Jesus talks about in Luke chapter 14, verse 26, when he says, if anyone does not hate his own mother or father or children or relatives or friends, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. He doesn't mean literally go around hating those people. What he's saying is, if you give love that is meant for me to those other people, you cannot be my disciple, because I need to be the priority recipient of your best and greatest love. What do we have going on in the world today? A lot of people loving anything but God and Jesus. What do we have going on in the brotherhood today? A lot of resistance to what we just said. We have brethren who love their families and love their parents and love their recreation and love their family time more than they love the Lord. You say, well, that's a pretty strong criticism. That's what I have observed through the fruits of what I have seen in brethren. Because we're all producing fruit of what we really believe over time. And if someone like me can see that, you got to believe that others see it too. And you got to believe that Jesus sees that as well. When Jesus divides his church in the great judgment to come, he will divide it between those who took care of him and those who busied themselves with anything else, with lesser things. The question is, which side will you be on? Because you can't exempt yourself. There's no third group, and only one group goes to glory. And that's where he wants you. He wants you in glory with him. Well, as I stated, we're living between two advents, two appearances of Christ. We cannot know when the second one is coming, but he is guaranteed to come. That advent is guaranteed to happen. So the question is, are you ready for his coming? And if you are ready, then that stands to reason that you and I are making necessary preparations for that coming. Since you know it's going to happen, then you are wise to prepare for that. Just like Noah, as you see in the picture here, Noah knew the flood was coming. Keep in mind, Noah had never seen a flood before. Noah had never seen the world flooded before. Noah may not have even seen rain before, for all we know. But he was told that the flood is coming and to build an ark, and that's what makes him faithful. Well, what about us? We're the same position. We've never seen the end of the world before. We've never seen all the elements burned up. We've never seen the whole world called to judgment, but we know it's coming. And what should we be doing? We should be building an ark, so to speak. We should be busy doing that. Are you busy doing the Lord's work? Well, you and I can't possibly be ready and busy if Christ and the work of his church is relegated to just a small little segment of your life, like, say, a couple hours on Sunday morning. If that is your work for Christ through the week, that says a lot, and it's not very flattering. You need to make him and his work a priority. Do not think that just because you're sitting here on a pew or sitting there on a Zoom call, that that somehow compensates for all that needs to get done, because it just doesn't. Are you taking care of the Lord's people? Again, you can't possibly be ready or prepared if you're giving more time and attention and preference to other things than God's people. In the judgment, you want to be on the sheep's side. But if that is so, that requires something of you and myself right now. If I want to be on the sheep's side, then I need to do what those sheep did in order to be there. And so do you. Otherwise, we're going to be on the goat side. And it's not going to go well for us. The purpose of this lesson is not to make you or myself feel bad if we're not ready at this moment. The purpose of this lesson is to say you need to get ready, and to provoke you in a positive way, I hope, in a bold but positive way, to be ready. The reason is because of this. If you are a Christian, you made a commitment to the Master to serve Him, to devote your life and heart and energy to His service. And if you are not a Christian here this morning, then you are still on the wide path that leads to destruction. And I'm imploring that you get off that path and do what is necessary to be ready while you still have time. And whether you are a Christian or not a Christian, attentive or not attentive, ready or not ready, the Master is still coming back. And He has given all of us fair warning, which means none of us can claim we didn't know or we weren't told, because this lesson takes away all of that excuse. Now you know. Now you've been told. My strong advice is to do whatever needs to get done with regard to your relationship with God, and to do it now, because you have no guarantee that you have tomorrow, and there will be no second chances once He comes. Be ready now. Get ready now. Do what you need to do. To those of you, and I know there are a bunch of you who are doing that, who've been doing that, and are genuine and sincere, you know, my commendation to all of you, because you're doing what you've been told to do. But then there might be some others of us who haven't been really taking this terribly seriously. And it's time to take it seriously. And that's one thing Daryl and I were talking about too. We're just kind of asking the question, who's taking this seriously? Because with Jesus, it's really, really serious stuff. But that doesn't necessarily mean it is to you or to me or to us. We have to choose that for ourselves. If there's any reason you need to come forward this morning, this will be your time to do so and respond to the lesson. You don't have to come forward to respond, but if you need to come forward in your response, this will be your time as we stand and sing the song Aaron has selected for us this morning.